Okay. Well, I think I can turn it over to Nick now. Nick, it's all yours.
Thank you, Steve.
So perhaps just taking a moment to find this body on this patch of the earth. The earth rising up to meet us, support this sitting. And the body kind of plunging down to meet the earth. Really feeling that this particular seated posture, knowing it. The position of the limbs, the whole length of the spine, the angle of the head. And the breath moving through the body, moving the body. It's taking that move towards intimacy with all the small micro movements that breathing entails. And this air that's swirling around, moving in and out of so many lungs. So drawing us all together. Seeing how much patience and willingness there is to tend to the movements of the breath. to know them. In that simplicity of letting all the rest go, all the preoccupation, all the juggling of past and future, just letting it all drop away so that it gets simple and intimate. So I think we usually take a little break at this point. Is it 5 minutes or 10 minutes? I can't remember. Five. Good. Okay. So let's meet back here at 6 minutes after seven. So I just want to say thank you for entrusting your Thursday evening to something that probably at least some of you aren't too familiar with. So just appreciate that. And welcome. It's really good to see you all. So I was thinking it might be interesting to explore what I called the paradoxical path of freedom. And I thought, I wonder if I'm using the word paradoxical quite correctly, but you can decide by the end of the talk if it's actually a good grammatical use, or I don't know if it's grammatical, but the meaning was, I started to wonder right after I had kind of realized what I wanted to offer. But anyway, I want to take a look at the traditional, the sort of Vipassana teaching on gratification, danger, and escape. How many of you are familiar with that teaching? Oh, cool. A little wavy hand from Fred. I find it quite an interesting teaching. And then it's got some Zen sort of, you know how the Zen version usually condenses the whole thing into a nutshell. So I thought it might be interesting to look at both, because I think these are some fairly chewy kind of teachings. There's some real substance there, and it's it's for me anyway quite surprising. And what actually surprised me the most when I started this path and got into the teachings for the first time, it was like, oh, this is taking me in the exact opposite direction that I would have expected. So there's some of that in these teachings of gratification, danger, and escape. So to start with the gratification, if you think of us, I often think of us as little amoebas, you know, like the little tiny one-celled beings. And, you know, we move towards food and warmth and safety and away from what's dangerous or threatening or too cold or, you know, not comfortable. So we've got this basic kind of biological urge for survival that takes us towards what's good for us, what supports us, and away from what's threatening us or making us uncomfortable. And so we've got that sort of basic biological drive. And then, as if that wasn't enough to contend with, we also live in a capitalist consumer society. And that is dependent on creating desire and kind of craving and in order to keep the whole show going. So there's this mechanism of creating desire, sort of engineering desire, so that we will want mass-produced goods. So we've got this sort of basic biology, and then we've got this thrust of a consumer society. And if you're interested in that, there's this great documentary called The Century of the Self that I highly recommend. And it's about, I had no idea how intentionally desire was engineered, and it's absolutely intentional. And there just came a time when we didn't need any more stuff. I think it was around, I'm not very good at dates, so I might not be remembering this rightly, but earlier in the last century, like maybe halfway through the last century, people didn't need more clothes or more stuff
they had enough if they had a couple of sweaters and a few pairs of pants. And so there was this really intentional move to create desire and to sort of manipulate, make us want more. And actually, it was really funny because I was just looking up something for this talk, and it was a definition of something, and on the side of the page there was this ad, and it said must have styles, and they even made this word must have with a little dash between must have styles, and I thought, that's it, this is the thing. So yeah, you know, we want stuff and we need stuff to survive. And then there's this other layer on top. And there's no problem with having comfort and pleasant sensory experience and safety and good food and all of that. The problem comes with our attachment to all of that. Not just our attachment, but our deep-seated belief that that is what's going to satisfy us and bring us happiness. So this is where we start coming into the danger area. So you've got the gratification where we're just responding to basic needs and also engineered kind of desires. And then the danger is that nothing lasts, of course, so the gratification can't ultimately satisfy us. And you know, that sort of sneaky promise that if we just get this thing, then we can rest and experience satisfaction. But of course, the danger is that shortly after that one urge is gratified, the next urge arises, and round and round we go on the wheel of samsara. So it's so tricky because there is some gratification. The desire thing does work up to a point. And yet it also kind of perpetuates this whole cycle of craving. And I think the other danger is that we'll settle for like a temporary fix and not go deeper and find a truer source, a more dependable source of happiness. So, yeah, the gratification comes in the form of pleasant sensory experience, and also comes in the form of self-making. The me that wants to give a worthy talk, you know, this sort of sense of becoming that can happen or that is constantly circling, just like the desires, the desire to be seen in a certain way, and also the desire not to be seen, you know, the me that shrinks back and wants to disappear and curl her toes if I give a talk that offends people, or, you know, people don't understand and are just confused. So, you know, this can happen in insight dialogue too, where you're suddenly in a breakout room if you haven't done it before, and this kind of me can arise of like, ooh, either I don't want to be seen, or I might talk a lot because of a nervous need to be seen. So it's this sort of, it's a bit like the bouncing between the various sense pleasures. There's the bouncing between the desire to be seen, the desire not to be seen. And so it is so easy to get caught and immersed and identified with this whole cycle. So we're just at the mercy of the pushing and pulling, with a me at the center trying to feel safe and stable and satisfied. And I put a little note in my notes here. There's a little koan that says, nothing to stand on, no place to fall. And for me, that points to this sort of becoming, non-becoming, that I can't raise myself up, and actually I can't even diminish the self either. There's nothing to stand on, no place to fall. And I was thinking about the allure of pleasure, and that might have been the word I was looking up, because I think this word allure is quite interesting. The way that there's a kind of glistening, enticing, sparkly thing, and then in fishing the lure has a little hook, and if the fish goes for that glistening, sparkling thing, it takes the bait and it's a little bit hooked. And I just found that an interesting sort of way of looking at this gratification and danger that, yeah, there's a drawback, there's a barb. And yes, there's satisfaction, and it can feel so good, and we can become sort of intoxicated or enamored or infatuated by that glistening thing. But ultimately, there's a little hook there, and we're then conditioning more desire and more desire, and we've sort of forgotten the Four Noble Truths, that freedom, happiness comes from actually letting go. Yeah. And I just want to be really clear that there's nothing wrong with what's pleasant. It's just the confusion we have that's where fulfillment lies, that's what's going to do it. And the danger is that we're investing and sort of putting our hopes and energies into things that we believe are going to deliver something that they're actually not capable of delivering. So it's confusing. Yeah. And it's amazing to me that even knowing this, as I'm sure we all do, we still go for that lure so much of the time. And actually there's a quote from, yeah, this is it. So this, I was so happy to hear this. Ajahn Amaro, I think it is actually, Ajahn Amaro. He said that 80% of the practice is knowing we need to let go and not being able to do it. You know, this is a monastic who's got all the depth of teaching, all the years of practice. And he's saying that 80% of the practice is knowing we gotta let go and we can't do it. We're just not able to do it. And I found that actually sort of alleviating, and also sort of softening, like it brings compassion to this dilemma that we're in. That we get caught. And I can't remember who said this other thing, but I thought it was quite a brilliant example of this. This is a long time ago. I was listening to a talk, and the teacher said that this gratification, danger, escape thing, it's like trying to convince a kid that water is better than Mountain Dew. And of course the kid wants something fizzy and sweet, and there's that allure, and yet, you know, we are just that kid who gets caught in the desire for the sparkle, the fizz, the something that's not just the plain water. So, yeah, here we are. is with that real need to be tender and kind with ourselves in this clinging that is so hard to manage and is often stronger than we are, you know. It's so deeply conditioned and so culturally supported, and it requires so much energy and ongoing determination to see clinging clearly and to kind of cultivate this loosening of its grip. Yeah, sometimes it's all we can do to just watch ourselves do it again, you know, go for the whatever treat from the fridge or whatever it is and just sort of go, yep, here I go. And it brings this sort of mix of happiness and suffering, and here we are. So I think the other thing that's really helpful is to be aware of those quiet little moments when there's no clinging, where there's just a contentment, sort of an ease and a being present. When that sort of hum of the engine of desire is absent. And those quieter moments often go by unnoticed, but there's something important there. Yeah. So the teachings are promising that there's a more deep and dependable happiness in the non-grasping mind, in the subtle taste of water. So perhaps let's just pause for a moment and see if there's clinging right now. Is there an urge to experience or acquire something pleasant, to be seen in a certain way or not seen at all? Or, yeah, what's the engine of desire? Is it kind of purring quietly or kind of got some real momentum, or is it fairly still just now? It's so tricky because it can be quite subtle, that kind of constant searching or evaluating. It's quite agitating when we're in the thrall of this craving for what's pleasant. And I think, of course, you know, the whole practice of meditation, steadying the attention, is the way through the kind of glittering allure, so that we're not so consistently getting hooked. And if we can stay centered and mindful, we can actually make choices out of wisdom rather than the push-pull, the up-down, the pleasure, the disappointment of habit, the habit body. So it's like we're not kind of led around by the nose anymore. And I think the second foundation is so vital here, where if we can have that awareness of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, we begin to see the impermanence of feeling tone and how fast it's changing. And that can help us to let go. So when the unpleasant arises, I sometimes think of it like walking, you know, left foot, the right foot, the left foot, and the pleasant, the unpleasant, pleasant, unpleasant, and the kind of effort it takes to try and always hop on the happy foot, you know. There's a lot of strain involved in kind of contorting our lives, or trying. I mean, it's not even successful because it's all so unpredictable, but just the effort of trying to always steer towards the pleasant and away from the unpleasant. And just having a sitting practice really gives us some practice with this, you know, just the, in really simple ways, the not going for the gratification of my to-do list and actually getting myself on the cushion. And, you know, when my face always itches for some reason. I've got this hair that sticks into my, sometimes it feels like a hair is drilling into my cheek or something, and I'm dying to just, and in resisting even that tiny impulse, we build we slowly build this capacity to be with the unpleasant, to watch its impermanence. It does go away, and drop by drop, this is the escape. And I just find it interesting that the three characteristics are right in here. The stress that might be subtle, but the sort of dukkha implied with the no permanent satisfaction coming from the things that we crave. And then the really knowing the impermanence of the feeling tone can help us. And then this knowing the lack of a stable, consistent, solid self as well. And just to drop in the Zen version here, I think it can be so helpful to just play with the koan hu. So it's just like, I think the formal version is who hears, but it's very often used of just like, who's tired? Who's anxious? Who's gratified? Who wants to be seen? Who wants to be recognized as a good student or a good teacher? You know, like this it can break down that identification with the self. And I just have to share my favorite ever Mary Oliver poem, which is just so short and so easy to memorize. And she says, "You're not much," I said to my reflection in a green pond, and grinned. So I'll read it again. "You're not much," I said to my reflection in a green pond, and grinned. And I really wanted to bring that in because I think it's pretty vital to have a sense of humor about this. You know, we're falling on our faces over and over and over again. And I think we need to sort of look at it with the same warmth and affection as we would a child who wants something sweet and fizzy rather than plain old water. So, yeah. Just want to check the time for a minute. Okay, yeah, I'm gonna finish up. Okay, just a few last things. So you're probably familiar with Winnie the Pooh, and there's a teaching there on gratification, danger and escape. Because Pooh Bear says he likes to have honey for breakfast and honey for tea. And that the best part is the moment before eating the honey. It's the anticipation of how it will be. And so I think this is such an interesting thing. You know, we can investigate the hankering in the mind, in the Tibetan tradition, they say that desire puts feathers on the object. So it's like, how satisfying are all these things when we actually do them? And so I just think it's just an interesting area to investigate. Does it match up with the promise? Does the experience we have actually match up with the promise? So, yeah. Yeah, we can't just push away the desire because that's sort of just another desire. So there's a need to watch it quietly. I'm actually just going to close my window because it's raining. Hang on a sec. So yeah, we can't just push it away. I think the real power is in the observing without getting too identified or lost. And yeah, really paying attention to how we're relating to the pleasant, the unpleasant, the neutral. So bringing in mindfulness and care, we can kind of wake up to the way that desire operates. And maybe the last thing I'll say is, just one sec, I closed the window. we have these wooden windows that if the rain gets in, it's not good. The last thing I want to just mention is that all of this kind of examination of what creates genuine happiness is reinforced by what they're discovering in neuroscience, and the happiness that comes from paying attention rather than from having and not having. And you might have heard of Willoughby Britton. She's a neuroscientist who studies meditation, and she says the research shows that happiness is not about having what we want. It's inextricably linked to the faculty of attention. So happiness comes from the mental habits we practice moment to moment. So maybe I'll finish with this. I don't have time. I thought I could squeeze more in, but I just love this line from Hafiz. He says, learn to recognize the counterfeit coins that may buy you just a moment of pleasure. So learning to recognize the counterfeit coins that may buy you just a moment of pleasure. And one final koan before we go into the contemplation, just because I can't resist. And this is a koan that I was so foxed by when I first heard it. I just thought, no way. But given this context of gratification, danger, and escape, I think it's just a little easier to penetrate it and sort of see what it might be saying. So this is Zen master Yunmen, and he's very well known for saying, I'd rather have nothing than something good. And that's the koan. I'd rather have nothing than something good. And I think in some ways this is the whole teaching of gratification, danger, and escape condensed into one line. So we're going to investigate this a little bit in pairs. And I just want to invite us to consider what's been our experience with learning to recognize these counterfeit coins that buy us just a moment of pleasure. How are we doing with this? And this is where I'm not sure if it's a paradox or not, but the paradox that the path of freedom and release points us in the exact opposite direction than what we're constantly conditioned to believe, that the accumulation of money and resources and the acquisition of stuff is going to be what brings happiness. So how do we live in this push-pull? What are the areas where we manage to simplify and cultivate this faculty of attention, which the science tells us is inextricably linked to happiness? And what are the areas where we need to let go? And as Ajahn Amaro says, we just can't do it. We're just not able to do it. So the invitation is to explore this with the sense of humor, the grin that Mary Oliver mentioned, and also the kindness, that the recognition that we are heavily conditioned by the media, hour by hour, day by day. So yeah, we'll have 6 minutes each, and let's have the first speaker be the one whose name starts the closest to the beginning of the alphabet. And in Insight Dialogue, what we like to invite is to, once you get into the breakout room and you've figured out who's going to speak, to just stop and pause and open up a little space for the response to this question to arise right there in the moment in the breakout room. And of course, you know, we've had ideas and stuff as we're listening. And see if you can not lock down on knowing what you want to say, so that you can sort of open the space and there's room for something fresh to rise up that might surprise you. And even if nothing rises up, that's fine. You know, it's meditation rather than conversation. So silence is really welcome, and actually will probably serve to deepen whatever is spoken when you do find something that rises up to the mind. So don't feel the pressure to rustle something up. You can just sort of float the question and see what bubbles up in response. So basically the question is, how are we doing with the push-pull of this gratification, danger, and escape? Really take your time. Okay, we have a few minutes. If there's anything that anyone would like to share at the end, you know, either about the subject in general or about what you experienced in the pairs. Looks like Jay would like to. Yeah, go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, thanks. So we had, Joan and I had a little two-person kind of back and forth dialogue. I hope that was okay in the spirit. And I was really, for me, really looking at, is there stuff that's a danger for me in my life? is what I use the word danger. And the more I looked at it, the more I felt like I wouldn't really say that if I have a strong desire, if I have had a big disappointment, I wouldn't use the word danger. I feel like if I can meet something, if I have a strong desire for something, and I kind of wonder, is this good or bad? Meeting it, listening to it, entering into it with the eyes open. It's the eyes open that feels like it brings in the intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I can trust. I don't have to think that it's danger. I may bump my knee, I may hurt my head, but there's a learning process. And there's also the joy of living out something in my life, discovering something directly.
Yeah. I'm curious if anyone did relate to that word danger, where it felt relevant or useful in some ways, or if you felt similar to Jay, that it was maybe too strong for a description of your own experience.
Well, maybe danger, suffering is what I equated to the danger. It causes suffering, so, and it doesn't feel good, so.
That's interesting. We can call gratification, suffering, and escape. We can rename the triad. Yeah. Anything else anyone would like to say? We've got another minute, but I know what we've done in the past is kind of have a closing for those that need to go, and then hang out for another 10 minutes in case there are things you'd like to say. So maybe raise a hand if you'd like to have a little bit more time, and we can see if there's enough of us to make that worthwhile. Yep. Okay, great. So it's 7:59, and maybe I'll ring a bell and we can release those who'd like to leave now and continue a little bit more together for about 10 more minutes. Looks like Tiska has something to say. Go ahead, Tiska.
I think that's a good equivalent of danger with suffering that Donna used. And I used this little example for myself that I've been watching. I recently just turned 75, three quarters of a century, pretty awesome. And I was at the museum, Albuquerque Museum, and I got myself a little trifle. I'm wearing it. It was a ring, and it was a turquoise color I've always wanted, and it was half price, and it was a fun day, and I went ahead, and I almost never buy anything frivolous. So I started taking it lightly of, oh, you know, I let myself be frivolous. That seemed like a good thing. And I would think that there was a possibility, I think the woman was saying it could be a statement ring. And it's like, oh, I could make myself be something with this ring, you know, that was kind of a hook she was offering. And I just kind of have chuckled over that. And I thought, you know, I'm just going to be light with this. I'm going to watch how it hooks me and doesn't hook me. I don't need a ring, didn't need a ring. So it's been kind of a crazy thing, but I think the danger and the exit was just to let it go. I'm just letting it be what it is. I'm playing with it. It's light. It's fun. if someone came to me and said, oh, I really need that ring, you know, for whatever reason, buy bread or have fun herself or themselves, I'd probably say, okay, you can have it, you know.
Yeah.
Just letting it go. That seemed to me what I took from the danger or the suffering, getting hooked, and that letting it make me be, define me in some way.
That's such a great example. Thank you, Tiska. And I think I thought you meant like a British trifle for a minute, you know, like a pudding. but what I wanted to just point to in what you said is that I think there's a really important thing in there, which is that to know our tendencies and to hold that, because if you were the sort of person who had maybe 87 rings and, you know, had purchased rings a lot, there's something really different in the energetic. So I think to just know ourselves and what our tendencies are is so important in this discernment of where wise action lies and what's fun and what's deep habit energy and what's actually fresh, because it can be beautiful either way, you know, to purchase the ring or not purchase it. It can be equally beautiful, but I think it depends on where our habits are. If it's freeing or not, you know, it's not in the action whether it's freeing or not. It's in knowing our habit energies, I think.
It felt fresh.
Yes. Yes. I love that you brought that example up, because I think it's an interesting one in that paradoxical kind of
yes.
part of it. Yeah.
Yeah, Nick. So I think what you just hit on, I mean, the energy behind the impulse, or just the fact that it's feeling the impulse of it. And that's usually, for me and probably for most of us, if we pay attention, we can recognize that habit energy and know it's probably something to just, you know, not act on in that moment, maybe, and then it just fades away. So what Charles Lee and I were talking about was just putting it, you know, on Amazon or something, and just, you know, I really want that, you know, whatever that is, but let's just put it in the cart for a little bit, you know, and don't press the you can buy it this second thing. And you know, 2 hours later, you're looking to go, oh, I don't need that, you know?
Wow.
I mean, you can see the habit, and you can see and feel how that root can rule you, you know?
Yeah.
That can just rule you. I mean, we can look around my office here and see all the books that I haven't read, you know? You know, so, you know, or we can look in my closet at the 500 CDs that are, you know, I don't do that anymore, but that, you know, I used to buy all the time. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I agree with everything that's been said and what Jay said as well, which is very similar, just
yeah.
being with what is arising and checking it out, you know, and smelling it, tasting it, seeing, you know, seeing where it's coming from. Yeah.
I love your strategy of put it in the basket, but don't actually press.
Well, that was actually, Charles Lee, I'm giving you all the credit on that one. You brought that up, buddy.
So, nice one, Charles Lee. That's really cool.
Very nice. Very nice.
Yeah. It wasn't my idea. It was a suggestion given to me. I have yet to really use it, but.
I think it might be powerful because of the lure sort of in the moment when we've been taken down a little path. You know, and then what you're saying, Fred, that when we're not on that path as much, yeah. It might not hold the same kind of glistening, it's kind of, sparkling.
Yeah. It's kind of just pausing, you know?
Like, yeah, yeah.
It's taking the pause that refreshes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, I had trouble. I was the first one to go in my couple, and I just couldn't relate to the question. And then I was with Tiska, and she mentioned just used the word letting go. And then it all kind of came together for me in a way. Yeah. Well, yeah, letting go is the escape in a sense. And just now thinking about it, I remember my first teacher, Joko Beck, she would talk about it lets go of us. We don't let go of it. And the way it lets go of us is by our being with it, whatever, you know, it is, it's happening. And it just seems simple to me. And that's it.
Yeah. Thank you, Mel. I think I'm curious, actually, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
So when I was offering the talk, were you relating to the talk, but then when it came to speak, there wasn't something, or had you not really related to the talk as well?
I related to parts of it. I'm just, you know, appreciated some of the things you shared, but I didn't really get the sense of what the talk was about, honestly.
Right. Yeah. And that's so interesting, isn't it? That just this phrasing, translating or using slightly different words can just open it up. And it makes me think like it's not such a great idea to prescribe who goes first, who speaks first, because actually some of us, I've been in the same position sometimes, someone will offer a contemplation and I'm like, huh? I haven't quite got there. And then my partner goes first and I'm like, oh, thank you. Now I'm on board. So I think it might be actually a good, that's great feedback that, yeah, let's leave it up to us, to whoever's in the breakout to make that discernment of who goes first so that we can kind of help each other in to the terrain. Yeah. Did you have your hand up, Donna, as well?
I did. And I just had another example of just feeling happy to be aware of what was happening. I had a situation this week. Somebody sent me a text first thing in the morning. J. Jill is having a 60% off sale. And I immediately got hooked, got on there, looking. And after about an hour, I just saw, I don't need anything. But I was just hooked because my friend was like, hey. And so I was just happy that I could see it.
Yeah.
And even if I did buy it, I would be happy that I was aware that I was hooked.
Yes.
So I really like that idea that it's just being attentive. It's not necessarily succeeding and letting go. And I love the statistic of 80%. So I feel I feel much better. So thank you for that.
Oh, that's all Ajahn Amaro. It was his kindness because I also felt so much better when he gave that statistic. But yeah, this is hard stuff. It is. But I'm right with you that, you know, it's just like with Tiska's ring. It's not whether we buy the clothing or the whatever it is. It's the awareness that accompanies that choice or doesn't. Like sometimes we're just totally carried away. And I think the other thing about what you're saying, Donna, that is funny to me, because I love a good bargain. You know, I can resist things if they're all at full price. I'm just like, oh, no, I don't want that. But if something's free or really a great bargain, then my greed kicks in and it's stronger to resist. You know, there's more to get over with the clinging. There's something that holds tighter if it's a...
But it was nice to be light about it, like when Tisca was saying, and laugh.
Yeah.
It's just laugh. You know, there it is again.
Yeah. I think that's the key with this, because otherwise it could just be a really miserable ride. Yeah.
I'm still kind of wrestling with this sense of the hook. And it reminds me of I was in a group one time, it had nothing to do with meditation, but somebody brought up a topic of guilty pleasures. And it was a fascinating thing, because none of the men in the group related to the concept. We all said, I don't have guilty pleasures. All of the women really related to it. And the men are going, well, if I like something, I get it. And if I don't like something, I don't get it. And so maybe what I'm missing a little bit here is this sense of being torn about, oh, I want this, but it feels like a hook. I guess in my personality, I don't think of it as a conflict. It's mm-hmm. Feel that way to me. I can see that, oh yeah, I always do that and it doesn't end up very good.
Right.
Typically feel it as always as a conflict like that. So maybe that's a little bit the vocabulary that we're using is I'm having a hard time reaching that vocabulary.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes some sense. Go ahead, Alice. Yeah.
Well, I just had the experience of moving all my possessions. And so that's a huge reminder of how much I have accumulated and held on to, so that I wanted to drag it from one place to another and then to another and then to another. And here I am now surrounded by all of it. It's really, you know, remarkable the quantity of stuff that one can accumulate in one's long history of wanting an acquisition.
Yeah. Yeah.
What if you had to move all those CDs, Fred? Thanks for listening.
I would give them. I wouldn't. They would just be given away. Come and get them, by the way, if you want. Get them more stuff. I'll give you my stuff.
You're going to have a hard time giving them away in this crowd, maybe. Or maybe not if they're free. Just kidding. But yeah. You know, there's one last thing that I didn't say that I think is quite, I don't know traditionally how it fits. I just know how it fits for me. Are you familiar with the teachings on that the pleasant, unpleasant and neutral? There's also worldly and unworldly pleasant, worldly and unworldly neutral, and worldly and unworldly unpleasant. And I think for me, one of the keys to this trio of gratification, suffering, and escape is knowing unworldly pleasant. Unworldly pleasant comes from meditative states. It comes from the sort of joy that's way more restful, not about sense objects or getting anything. And I think for me, a key to not get caught is to really know and cherish the unworldly pleasant. Does that make sense? Just because it's so very pleasant, you know, to be in that state of no clinging, really restful, where the mind is just really attentive and still and, you know, kind of in a good groove on retreat usually. But yeah, I think remembering the unworldly pleasant might be a support in this process of unhooking. So just a thought to leave you with. Oh, all right, dear ones. Yeah.
Thank you, Nick.
And if you want,
thank you, Nick. Thank you. It was great.
That's great. Thank you so much for being here.
Great to see everybody.
Thank you.
Yes, everyone. Good night.
It's always good to see.